True crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?
Good day. Moscow police on the defensive as more and more questions are asked about the leadership and experience in the investigation. That as we come closer and closer to week seven with no answers and a killer still on the loose. I'm Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any breaking updates and conversation on this case. We're going to begin with Moscow Police Chief James Fry defending his view of strength on his investigation this afternoon in a recorded statement.
So I know there's been some questions about the leadership in this investigation. What I want people to know is this is a Moscow Police Department investigation. We're utilizing the resources of the FBI and state police, but we pick the investigators. My command team oversees this. We have 94 years of experience between us, and we're going to continue to work this case. We're going to continue to work it to the completion. We have a lot of resources that we're utilizing, but we still ask for your help. We ask for any tips that you might have, anything that you might be able to give us. We're going to take a look at those, but be assured that this investigation is the Moscow Police Department's, and I am the chief, and we're going to follow through with this. And just know that from the very beginning of this, we've been a unified group. And we make decisions together, but those ultimately, I stand behind at the end. I'd like to update you on our tips so far. We've received 7,600 email tips. We've received 4,300 phone tips. We've received 4,500 digital tips. All of this helps build the picture that we're trying to put together here to solve this case. What we want you to know is we appreciate all your help. We appreciate everything you've done, but we're asking that if you have anything additional, please just send it to us through our tip line or through our email tip line. We appreciate that.
We'll discuss that statement in just a moment, but first, investigators say that they are aware of the Hyundai Elantra located in Eugene, Oregon, that appears to have been involved in a crash and abandoned, saying that they are working with the local jurisdiction to determine if the vehicle is related to their case. That statement made last night. In the last hour, Eugene police telling Court TV that a Hyundai Elantra reported with damage and no plates in Eugene, Oregon, does not appear related. We have no information to indicate it is related to the Moscow, Idaho case, according to the Eugene police. This is another video believed to be taken on the night of the murders at a local downtown business is known to investigators. Moscow police saying investigators have identified an individual called Adam in the video, and he is cooperating with detectives. That is the rest of today's release goes on to state again, as it has in almost every release, the sheer number of pieces of evidence coming in, how long it's taking them to look through it, and the 22,000 vehicles they're also looking through. As they say, no suspects have been identified, and only vetted information that does not hinder the investigation will be released to the public. Still asking for help in the investigation. There's a link in the description to this episode if you have anything to share with the Moscow Police Department. With that, we're going to go to Anne Bremner. She's a trial attorney and legal analyst to discuss this case. And there isn't a lot of patience finding the perpetrator of these horrific murders. It's just understandable. The public has very little tolerance for things not going very quickly. And sometimes that's not how it always works in a murder case. But the fact that we're now more than 6 weeks into this with very little information coming out, a profile of who to look for or anything, should the public feel discouraged at the progress of this investigation?
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of conventional wisdom that you've got to solve something like this in the first 72 or 48 hours, or at least have something to hang on to. I mean, a murderer usually leaves something behind and take something with them. That's also conventional wisdom. So I'm worried that this is a small police department and they've only had a homicide, 7 years ago?
Yeah.
So they're, even though they brought in the FBI, I'm just kind of a little leery about where they are right now. They keep saying, we're not going to give information, but then I wonder, do they have any information?
That's what I think a lot of people are wondering at this moment. And maybe you can help clear this up. A lot of people have the question because we know the FBI is involved. We know the state's involved. But it was stated very clearly just moments ago from the chief of police, James Fry, that he is the head of this investigation.
Yeah, I saw it.
Everything goes through him. And right. we should, quote, be assured that it's going through the Moscow Police Department. I think that's kind of the problem most people have with this investigation, is that it's going through the Moscow Police Department as the lead. Is there a reason? Is this logistics? Why is it that this small police department that doesn't have a lot of experience in this, when you add up all the people, only leads to like, what, 90 years, 94 years of experience amongst all of the people? Not stuff that you really want to hang your hat on and say, we're prepared for this. Why is it that they are the lead and not the FBI? Can you explain that at all?
Sure. And you know, I had the Susan Cox Powell case. She disappeared in Utah, presumed murdered by her husband. Her kids were killed by the husband in Washington, but she's never been found. That was a smaller department. It was the West Valley City Police. And the detective on the case had never had a homicide. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, you're limited by virtue of their experience.
Sure.
And that was not resolved. She hasn't been found. And the kids, of course, were killed by the dad because he had them through CPS. It's their jurisdiction. You know, it's their case. Mm-hmm. They can bring in other agencies. But here's something that's very rarely used. And that is, I did this in the Rebecca Sahau case down in Coronado. To take it from the local department and ask the attorney general, that was the law in California, to find misfeasance or malfeasance and appoint an outside agency, i.e. the FBI, to spearhead the investigation. That's about all you can do. I mean, I saw his press conference just now, and he's like, this is my case, this is our case, and we're going to be in charge of it. But maybe that's not the best idea. I just don't know.
Could they just say, look, these people are much better equipped to handle this than us, and we're going to make them the lead? Do they have the choice to do that? Or is it their choice right now to continue to hold on to this without the FBI becoming lead?
That's a good question. I'm in Washington State. We're right next to Idaho where mm-hmm. this happened. And I'm not privy to their administrative acts and laws, but you know that you can always bring in other agencies if you need the manpower or womanpower, and even, you know, anoint them in some leadership role, you know, beyond yours. I think that, you know, when you look at this case, and I have to say, my sorority is the Pi Phi House, and two of the girls were all in my sorority, the Pi Phi House. Uh-huh. So there's been a lot of talk there, you know, to the sorority. But, you know, you lose four young people like that. They said it was a really sloppy crime scene. There's sightings of various people in one vehicle. There has to be some kind of clue right now that's beyond just mere speculation.
What kind of things operationally can you, I mean, obviously not specifically on this case, but just more uh-huh. so in the bigger picture, what kind of things are going on behind the scenes operationally right now in a case like this that the general public would be unaware of?
Well, all the crime scene analysis. I mean, I don't know what they did at the scene, but I thought it started a little bit late. You're looking at, you know, all of the phone data in cars, you know, all of that surveillance, canvassing the neighborhood. I mean, all kinds of ways to figure out. I mean, somebody saw something or heard something. People are pretty close together there. I know they're looking at that Hyundai that's in Eugene, mm-hmm. Oregon, it's wrecked, but they can take a look at that car and get data, I believe, from that car to see if it was in the vicinity. I saw an expert say that that's a borderline year for whether that would be. That car would be equipped in such a way that you could get information from it. But there's all kinds of things, yeah. And, you know, that they can do.
And recently, honestly, in the last hour, there was information that came out from the Eugene police saying that they do not believe that car was involved with the Moscow incident at all. So that's almost kind of up for dismissal right now. Earlier, they were saying direct questions to the Moscow police, but the Eugene police saying they don't believe it is.
Well, yeah, one thing I've been a little critical of in this case is dismissing suspects and evidence too readily.
I mean,
I don't know, you know, and so to say this person isn't a suspect, this person is a suspect, etc. It's pretty hard to clear people unless they have like a solid alibi. And the Susan Cox Powell case had an abandoned car. I think it was in Oregon. Mm-hmm. It might have been in Washington. that had her DNA, not DNA, it had decomposition dog actually indicated the trunk of the car, indicating she might have been in the trunk of that car. It belonged to Josh's brother and was abandoned. And so you look at that, like, have they checked those kinds of things? We don't know. They call them cadaver dogs.
Yeah, that was pointed out in an interview I did earlier in the week of where are the dogs? Yeah. Why were there no dogs immediately out on the trail of this?
Oh, I know. I know. It's just, and I represented the Seattle Police Canine Unit in a class action. Those dogs are magic.
Sure.
I mean, we don't hire them for their bites. We hire them for their nose. You know, they can find, they go across freeways and across Lake Washington, you know, to find their person. So police dogs would have been key. And I didn't see, you're right, there's no indication that they use canine units. Do they have a canine unit? I don't even know.
Yeah, they may not even have one. What kind of a time frame is on something like that before the scent will be gone, where the canine is no longer going to be useful in a situation like this?
I'm trying to remember. It's not super long. I mean, you could still give it a try. When you're cadaver dogs, of course, I think that's a different time frame. Mm-hmm. But when you're looking for basically dogs tracking and finding somebody, as long as they're not getting confused scents, you know, there was a lot of other people around, things mm-hmm. like that. It could go for, I would imagine, a few days. But they didn't try. I mean, our canine unit's always out and ready to go, starting at 9 at night mm-hmm. here in Seattle. And that's usually when they're needed. You know, sure. They go out and they do their job and they catch the bad guys.
So at this point, this far in, likely nothing that could be done using a cadaver dog or a canine unit.
I don't think so. But I had that case some time back, and I'm not up on, you know, some of the newer information about how they're using the dogs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're a great tool. They're just a great tool and could have been very useful.
If the suspect is laying low, and obviously there's doing something that's not being seen or suspected, in your experience, would you think that they are far away from Moscow at this point? Or is this one that's blending into the community every day and no one has any clue about? I know it's just a conjecture question, but I'm curious from what you've seen in your experiences.
You have to think that this person either is a serial killer or knew the victims, or at least one of the victims. And so could they be right next door? Sure. Could they be just blending into the woodwork? Sure. But I mean, I keep thinking of Ted Bundy in Florida with Kyle Mega House. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was somebody that was staying right there. He was staying in a nearby house when he had, you know, committed those crimes against all those women. Or who was the one in DeSalvo and the Boston Strangler? Mm-hmm. You know, individuals like that, that kind of just go and kill a bunch of people and they don't go too far away.
Sure. That makes sense. Is there a reason you would say why we have normally, at least from the public standpoint, so I don't want to say normally to everything, you have far more insight on this than I do. A somewhat of a description is put out there. If there's nothing physical to give, there's kind of a profile psychologically. Here's the type of person we're looking for. Is there a reason why we don't have anything like that released at this point in time?
Because they don't know. That's what I think.
They just don't know. Yeah.
They just don't know. And I think they made two mistakes. I mean, they don't know and they don't have information, but yet they came out with too much information mm-hmm. about, remember they said people aren't at risk. It was targeted. And then all of a sudden, well, it's graduation. You better be careful. The first bad guy could be out there. And then they say, we've eliminated these people. Etc. When maybe that's not the case, it's better just to say it's under investigation to tell the public how safe or unsafe they are, so they can, you know, act accordingly. But also inform the families to the extent that you can, and then tell the public if you have things that are solid, which I don't think they do.
Early on, when they said targeted, and then backed that up a few days later, saying not targeted, or we just right. don't know, was that ignorance, just them yeah. jumping to conclusions, or did they overstate something that they maybe have more in their back pocket that we're unaware of?
I think that they may well have had more than one spokesperson, and so somebody said something and then somebody else backtracked it. That's kind of my thought. Mm-hmm. In the Susan Cox Pell case, they kept coming out and saying Josh Pell is a suspect. He's not a suspect. He's a person of interest. We're not looking at him. Things like that. It was very confusing. And in that case, people relied on assurances, you know, that he was a suspect, they were getting ready to arrest him, etc. So people here in Washington, CPS that had custody and control of his children, mm-hmm. basically were like, well, he'll get arrested and then we'll be done, you know, with our need to take care of these kids. And so they gave the kids back to him and he killed them. So that's a gross example of, you know, reliance on some kind of wishy-washy public statements of a police department.
Yeah, one saying that this is safe and then not safe. The other thing, and I am not pointing fingers at any individual whatsoever, but the fact that just so many people almost immediately within days were seemingly cleared of this. Is that even a logistical possibility, the amount of people that seem to be cleared so quickly?
I don't think so. I mean, even if you have an alibi, you've got to really analyze that. And if you do, maybe say how you did it, just so people feel more comfortable with the investigation. Because if you're going to school there, anyone going to school there, is pretty scared.
Sure. And that seemed to be a big point that Steve Gonsalves has made a few times of, okay, you cleared these people. We're good with that. Tell us what the alibis are. And my question right. would be, what's the hurt in releasing what the alibis are?
Zero. Nothing. I mean, if they're cleared, tell us why. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand why they don't say, you know, how they're cleared. It's just hard to believe that they could so quickly clear that many people. That's all.
And that's the question is kind of the protocol of it. In other investigations, when someone is cleared, do the FBI, does local police typically release that information so everybody is on the same page, including the public, when there does appear to be a dangerous threat that's out there?
You know, there's ethical constraints on the prosecutor's office, which I'm sure is guiding them. And then the police, of course, have certain standards, you know, with respect to not compromising their investigation by what they say publicly. Mm-hmm. But clearing people, A, was not necessary to report, and B, seems to be based on insufficient evidence. But I think they're trying to act like they're telling everybody what's needs. You know, people want information, but that's not the information they want, because I don't think people are confident about those clearances.
Well, and the level of contradiction that seems to have yes. been coming out of the office. People want to feel safe. It's feeling a little tone deaf, especially with the statement this afternoon, the be assured that this is the Moscow Police Department's case. That's what people are not assured about, is that very,
I know.
That very topic, that very thought. That's what's making people go, are they that unaware that that is like one of the core things that the families, that many are feeling very questioning about? Are they trying to change everybody's mind because somehow they think they're going to come through with this? Are they sitting on something that's about to break? Or is it a lot of, you know, I hate to say this, there are a lot of saving face going on here.
You know, I've represented police departments for years, Seattle Police, you know, Portland, King County Sheriffs. I just finished defending our Pierce County Sheriff here about a week ago in a mm-hmm. case. But, you know, police, they tend to kind of band together. They're very clannish. You know what I mean? They've got a lot of brotherhood, you yeah. know, or sisterhood. But also, if you attack them and say, you don't know what you're doing, they're probably going to come out and say, yes, we do. And this sure. is, you know, who's in charge? I mean, you see it over and over again. You saw it in the Susan Powell case, and you see it in a lot of, you know, different cases where the police may be a department, may be a really small agency, but they could be the mouse that roars. I mean, they could be yeah. doing a phenomenal job. We don't know.
And I think the general consensus is nobody wants to be against the police. People just want to be sure right. that there's the best people in place to handle this case at the right time.
Exactly.
It's not going, shame on you for not having enough experience. It's not your fault. Nobody was expecting this in a town like this. But then it's just to have the decency and the sense to say, I'm not qualified to do this. Is that something where you've seen in your work with police departments difficulty sometimes passing the torch or raising a hand and saying, you know, we're probably not the best fit for this, but these guys are?
Yeah. And I used to be a prosecutor. And we had homicide prosecutors. We have them now. It's called the Most Dangerous Offender Program, where these prosecutors just do homicides. They go to the scene. They go to the autopsies. Mm-hmm. They're specialists. Those are the prosecutors. You know, then they work with homicide detectives, actual homicide detectives. I don't even know if there's a homicide detective in the Moscow Police Department. There must be. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about in Seattle, quite a large unit of homicide detectives that have been at it for many years and are specially trained. So, you know, it's just with smaller jurisdictions, it's very difficult. And this is the biggest murder case to hit the United States in a long time.
Sure. With the prosecutor right now, I mean, having formerly been one, what are what's their role right now? What are they watching for and also watching for as obviously, ultimately, this going to trial at some point in time? What kind of missteps and such are they really trying to make sure that the police don't commit and to avoid, so that if this does go to trial, if they do find someone at some point, this can be a very open and shut case? Because obviously technicalities are something that many people do get off on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're going to want to have more confidentiality from the police. I mean, police can say things that can really hurt cases, you know, that could come into the trial, you know, if they make certain public statements that adversely affect the accused. But they're also approving search warrants that are being issued in the case, you know, for legal sufficiency, and hopefully overseeing the, you know, forensic examination. I don't know in Moscow. It's a small town. That would be true in Seattle, but I don't know if that would be true there, that a prosecutor would be hands-on before charging, because the prosecutor really gets involved at charging.
Mm-hmm. And until that happens, is there much involvement with the prosecutor at this point?
Well, you know, in the Cox case, the Utah, the prosecutors did get involved, and they had sealed documents in that case so that information couldn't get out. And that was so that the prosecutor basically said, we won't prosecute without a body. So the police thought their hands were tied. I don't know in Idaho how they do it in Moscow. I just know, I mean, I've lived in the Northwest my whole life, and Moscow, Idaho was just kind of ancillary to WSU. It was kind of the town back when the drinking age was different in Washington. The kids would all go to Moscow. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's all I knew of it. And it's very small and it's got an excellent university, but it's a jurisdiction that hasn't seen a lot of mayhem and murder.
One more question before we wrap up. Based on your experiences, if you were to, you know, be brought in as a consultant or something on this tomorrow, just from what you know that's been public facing thus far, what would you say are some steps to help right this train in terms of the image that they're having to the families and to the public, and to make more progress on this case?
You know, I would publicly put forth the FBI individuals that are assisting in the next press conference with the chief, and indicate their expertise in forensics, you know, in terms of technology with a vehicle or phones or surveillance or anything else. I mean, they've got everybody's phones. That's a treasure trove of information in a criminal case. And I would make sure that I wasn't telling the family members things that I didn't want to get out, because it looks like we're having that happen too. And at least one family is pretty antagonistic towards the police because they feel like they need to know more. I also would make sure that I gave briefings maybe once a week or once every couple of weeks. Don't go out there all the time talking about it. I mean, the public has a right to know for the public safety, but you've got an investigation that needs to have integrity that leads to an arrest and conviction.
Ann Bremner, thank you for joining us and giving us your insights today. Ann Bremner, a trial attorney and legal analyst. That's going to wrap up today's episode of the program. Thank you guys for listening. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any updates and breaking updates to this case as we get them in. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening to another edition of 4 Killed for What.